quote-unquote satanic cults, which we will be discussing in some depth, and we will give you our standard disclaimer on that in a few moments, and we will be touching briefly on the Robert F. Kennedy assassination, which seems to be, for a 20-year-old assassination, a rather timely issue.
Yeah, well, Nip, why don't you give them a little rundown on just what the archives are, because this evening is not only going to be an archive show in and of itself, not only will that be a really cute way of feeding into my announcements of the upcoming archive shows this coming Wednesday on KKUP and 2 weeks from now this Wednesday on KFJC, it also will give us a chance to talk about how the archive shows are used, because for the last 6 months or so, we've been dealing with one of the most complex and I think perhaps controversial, although from the audience response, one of the most popular things we've ever hit on, namely the use of satanic cults not only as specific organs of Nazi political activity, but specifically also as fronts for elements of the U.S. national security establishment, which in and of itself, again, as we've said so often, we're not talking about the devil, and that the whole idea of Satanism, although undoubtedly many of the individuals believe in it, serves as much as a cover as anything else. It is a subject that almost invariably invites either sensationalism and or ridicule. Just, you know, a whole bunch of Friday the 13th type propeller beanie commandos, you know, are gonna come in the door behind anything about Satanism. And for precisely that reason, it's an ideal vehicle. Really here, I think from a useful standpoint, people could think of Nazi rather than Satanism. But tonight's broadcast, I think, is gonna help locate a lot of people a little more comfortably in the basic subject material of our broadcast, namely Satanism as a front for Nazi and official political activity.
Now, as Dave mentioned, this is going to be pretty much an archive show. This is since we had finished the original series of Radio Free America archive broadcasts, which I will go explain quickly for those of you who are not familiar with it in just a moment. But since we finished the original series, we still have archival material that we want to store, that we want to put into the record banks. But what we do now is occasionally we do it on the One Step Beyond show instead and concentrate on one subject. And that's, in fact, what the archive broadcasts are. They're meant to be resources, and they tend to, as opposed to the regular shows, which are sort of potpourri shows, which may cover 5 or 10 different topics during the course of the information portion, the archive broadcasts tend to be fairly narrowly focused, because that's the whole point of an archive. You can go to something and you can look it up and just check on a particular thing.
In a second, I'm going to give you announcements about some upcoming archive shows, but it's precisely because we've had so many of them to date, they are cumulative, and they build upon one another. Each is, in a sense, built upon the foundation of the previous shows. Tonight's broadcast, for example, is going to be particularly derivative, I guess you could say. But at some point, we were reaching the bounds of practicality. If we don't start playing the other shows from 4 years ago, you know, it isn't enough for me to sit here and say, you know, just go check RFA number one. I mean, not everybody at this point. There's something like $400+ worth of tapes in the archive series is up around $500 retail now, and it's just not everybody is plunked down that much. So we are beginning to rebroadcast some of the earlier shows specifically so people can begin laying their own foundation, because there are new people tuning in all the time, and yet we have old timers who go all the way back to 1980 and 81 with us.
Absolutely. And for those of you who are not going to be able to tape tonight, as we mentioned, the shows that become archive broadcasts are permanently available, and we'll be giving you addresses and such for that later in the broadcast. For those of you who don't have them already inscribed in letters of flame on your forebrain, we will be giving those addresses again. And the regular One Step Beyond shows are usually available for a period of up to a month or so. So you don't have quite the leeway as far as holding off on getting a hold of those, but they also are available. But the best solution of all, as we're telling you tonight going in, is just to tape it yourself if you're going to want to keep a hold of the information. Tonight's broadcast will be focused. It will be basically a Radio Free America. It's just not called that, and it will be more like 2.5 hours instead of the 4 hours that we usually put in on the archive broadcast.
Tonight, as we did 2 weeks ago with the second archive show about the use of Satanism as a front for Nazism and intelligence activity, you could call it Ultimate Evil 2, we went back and relied heavily on the archives, both long excerpts from RFA number 5 and long excerpts from a recent One Step Beyond show. An archive show, much as we're doing this evening, called The Pink Triangle, were used. And the Fritz Haarmann case is something to bear in mind again because of the influence of the Third Reich on the development of our national security establishment. And the appearance about 20-odd years ago in here in California under Ronald Reagan of very similar kinds of activities to what we were accustomed, what we have seen in our trip back to Hanover, Germany in 1923.
And one last thing I wanted to throw in, because we got a letter this evening going through the mail that's actually from a person that I know, although I don't think they know that that I am the person on the broadcast, because, of course, Nip/Tuck is a radio name. But anyway, without going into great detail about it, this person wrote a letter because they were concerned that talking about Satanism as much as we have lately, that we were going to be giving people the idea that all alternative religions were you know, some kind of satanic, you know, tool of the Satanists, or et cetera, et cetera. And this listener in particular referred to things like Wicca, which is the actual witchcraft, except in the benevolent and earth mother sense of things. And of course, we hasten to say, as we always do, that Dave and I are not peddling any kind of religious philosophy or anti-religious philosophy whatsoever up here. We do wind up talking about cult groups a lot, because so many of them are just what we're talking about, masks for intelligence activity.
Well, one of the complicating factors in the whole thing is that frequently, I guess one could call them legitimate alternative religious organizations, are infiltrated for the purposes of spinning people off into some of these federal mind control cults. Occult organizations of any type make ideal intelligence fronts, and the ideal intelligence front is one which serves as a vehicle for intelligence activity, but a large number of whose members are not aware of that. Those are the most ideal people to make a foil if your activities are ever uncovered, are people who are sincerely ignorant of the activities of others. And in any kind of occult organization, an institution like an espionage or like an intelligence organization or the military can make an awful lot of hay because of its very nature.
Now, so I would just, in adding to that, point out to the listener who was concerned enough to write a letter, and to anybody else who's listening, that I would say, if there's any basic tenet that is being put forth on this show, it's a certain leeriness of any kind of organization that one doesn't know much about, religious or otherwise. We've talked before about some questions that we have about various other groups that there's necessarily anything wrong with them, but that people have raised questions or whatever, and some of these are political groups, some of them are religious groups, and we wouldn't suggest to anybody that we have the final truth on these people of any kind or in any of these organizations. All we say is keep your eyes open if you're involved with a group like this or whatever, and that includes the, you know, straight line religious denominations as well. If you're involved in you know, some branch of that looks pretty strange to you, you know, take care and be aware, and that's all we're saying.
It should also be noted, I think, perhaps for the purposes of assuaging people's feelings, perhaps in the past, perhaps in the present, or perhaps in the future, that it would be useful to distinguish between our, I guess you could say, our conscious research viewpoint and my occasional asides. I have a very high opinion of God and an extremely low opinion of religion in general, and I'm not biased, be it, you know, the P2 wing of the Catholic Church, or some of these New Age lint heads who wind up with a 38 and wind up in church blowing somebody's head off with a smile on their face, you know, and then they don't know nothing. People should distinguish between my occasional irreverent asides, because I regard God as in the realm of religion and religion in the realm of politics, largely. You know, my own personal views, which are more mature and self-critical than I sometimes let on, because I frequently enjoy parroting myself, and that's an unusual enough characteristic in this godforsaken society that just distinguish between it. As I say, my overall, you could call it Emory's razor, is my test of religious faith for religious fanatics of any stripe is to defecate in one hand and pray with the other and see which fills up first. But that is strictly an unofficial, idiosyncratic position and should not be confused with the views or management of the views of the staff or management of One Step Beyond.
So for the last time tonight, before we get on with the body of the thing, we have given the standard Satanism disclaimer, when, as we say, and we say it, and we'll say it again just to make sure people understand, we're not talking about Satan, we're not talking about religious beliefs, God or the devil, we're talking about organizations that are being manipulated, or appear to be being manipulated, in many cases for very pragmatic, very matter-of-fact, and very unpleasant earthly ends. So
we're paying more attention to swastikas than maypoles.
Absolutely.
At any rate, let me tell you of a couple of things coming up. First of all, this coming Wednesday from 8 p.m. to midnight on sister station KKUP, which is at 91.5 FM and in mono only, so don't have your stereo light on, but be tuned in and be ready to tape for Radio Free America number 8, which will be an illustration of how some occult groups or religious organizations can be used for very nefarious activities. It deals with the Martin Luther King assassination, the 20th anniversary of which was a few weeks back, It will, however, touch on Jonestown, among other things, this by way of illustrating what we're talking about. Then, coming up 2 weeks later, on June 1st, also a Wednesday, right here on KFJC, from 7 p.m. to 11 p.m., Radio Free America number 3. This a very good example of why we wind up talking about Nazi influences on the U.S. national security establishment. That program, again, Wednesday, June 1st, 7 p.m. to 11 p.m., we'll deal with the Galen Spy Organization, the Nazi Eastern Front intelligence outfit, which became America's eyes and ears on the East Bloc and Soviet country, the Soviet Union and East Bloc countries for most of the significant post-war period, and proceeded to foul the waters of American democracy beyond a point contemplated by even the 1934 coup plotters, who did a pretty good job on their own. But that's Wednesday, June 18th, or Wednesday, May 18th, KKUP, 91.5 FM, mono only, 8 p.m. to midnight, RFA 8. Wednesday, June 1st, 7 p.m. to 11 p.m. right here on KFJC, RFA number 3. Also on the Sunday of Memorial Day weekend, our regular One Step Beyond show will, for our prepared portion, we will have Uncle Sam and the Swastika for the 8th straight year. Also, if I can finagle it with the programming department, which I'm going to have to get busy finagling as it's closing rapidly, I didn't realize that Sunday, June 4th, will be the 20th anniversary. It's Sunday, June 5th. If the first is a Wednesday, second will be a Thursday. Sunday, June 5th will be the 20th anniversary of the RFK assassination. Maybe we can get an airing of RFA number 9 if we can get an extension of time on that particular evening, seeing as how there will only be one 20th anniversary. I had a scary thought, speaking of archive shows, Nip. It was 2 years ago this evening that we were doing RFA number 19, part 3 of the Pope series, because it was on the 1st, 8th, 15th, 22nd, and 29th of May, 1986, right. 5 successive Thursdays. 2 years ago we were doing that. I remember when it looked like 2 years in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Time do fly.
Yeah, when you're having fun.
Particularly when you're a member of the Order of the Vampire and achieve invisibility, like
right.
The Temple of Set and Lieutenant Colonel Michael Aquino, the second beast of the apocalypse. At any rate, a rundown for tonight's broadcast. And by the way, all of our archive shows, including the program that's coming up this week, this evening, are available from a tape duplication service that's called Archives on Audio. That's Archives on Audio. I'll give you the address at the end of the broadcast. Now, a rundown of tonight's program, and again, no time for phone calls this evening. We're going to have a brief introduction in which we're going to take a look at who Brooke Shields has been dating. She's been going out with a fellow who plays the bartender Woody on the show Cheers, the hit comedy.
Let's save the surprise.
Okay, and you're going to find out a little bit about Woody's background. Let's just say Woody has a real good red-blooded all-American pedigree, and just how all-American and red-blooded we're going to show you. And it is very American in a sad sort of way because it is so very red-blooded. We're then going to take a look at just some of the red blood in his background. And after that, we're going to take a look at the background of a fellow who's assisting Judge John Walsh. And he's red-blooded as well. We're going to take a look at some of the red blood in his background. And we're going to toss out a little piece of research for the One Step Beyond audience to see if they can find out perhaps if his background is even more red-blooded than we've been able to find out so far. That sounds quizzical enough. However, that's what's coming up. So tune in for a disgusting, albeit cheerful, little introduction before the regular portion of tonight's broadcast. Then we will take a brief musical break. Then we're going to begin filling in, I think, in a substantive way, the intelligence underpinnings of some of the satanic cults that we're looking at. And I think it will locate many of our long-time listeners and short-time listeners as well, perhaps, in what we're doing somewhat more effectively than we have in the past. We're going to begin by taking a look at part of the preparation, part of the painting of Lee Harvey Oswald as a communist. We're going to take a look at the intersection between 544 Camp Street, the Fair Play for Cuba Committee of New Orleans, of which Lee Harvey Oswald was the only member at the time, and the Cuban Revolutionary Council, which is the CIA's anti-Castro Cuban umbrella organization, both of which, curiously enough, occupied the same address in New Orleans. An unlikely situation, but that doesn't seem to have troubled most of American historians and journalists because they've ignored it. We're then going to take a look at the intersection between that milieu and an organization called the Information Council of the Americas, and in particular, a fellow named Ed Butler. For Ed Butler arranged a highly unlikely radio discussion between Carlos Bringier of the aforementioned Cuban Revolutionary Council, the anti-Castro CIA organization, and Lee Harvey Oswald of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. By the way, although we're not going to have it in the main body of tonight's broadcast, New York researcher Ted Gandolfo has recently obtained a declassified freedom, a declassified House Select Committee document, or I guess it's actually a declassified CIA document, which was obtained by the House Select Committee on Assassinations, which confirms that Lee Harvey Oswald's CIA number was 110669. It is now a matter of record. He did not kill President Kennedy or anyone else. However, it's significant to note the setting up of the legend of Lee Harvey Oswald, as one author talked about it. But again, his courtesy of Ted Gandolfo of New York City, Oswald's CIA number was 110669 for the record, for when somebody, you know, some aliens come down in UFOs and disinter the remains of our civilization. Perhaps that'll be in a time capsule somewhere down the line. We're going to take a look at Lee Harvey Oswald's interview with Carlos Bringier, set up by Ed Butler of Army Intelligence, the Information Council of the Americas, with direct links to the Cuban Revolutionary Council. Then we're going to play you that particular interview. It is included in the main body of the Guns of November, and we will include it in a redoing of the Guns of November this coming November. But those of you who would like to hear the Ed Butler interview with Carlos Bringier, with Bill Stuckey and Ed Butler, the Oswald interview is going to be aired this evening. Then we're going to air a long section of Radio Free America number 12, which is going to talk about some other interesting Ed Butler activities. His presence at a very curious press conference the day after Robert Kennedy was assassinated, in which an anti-Castro freedom fighter, quote-unquote, attempts to link Saran Saran to Fidel Castro and the communists. Interestingly enough, that meeting was attended by, among others, Ed Butler, who had since moved to California to go to work under the auspices of Patrick Frawley, who was not only a close political ally and backer of Ronald Reagan, part of Reagan's so-called kitchen cabinet, but also was a key member of the American Security Council, one of the key American links to the World Anti-Communist League. And then we're going to take a look after that at Ed Butler's work on behalf of a Frawley publication called Aware, the Square publication, in which he attempts to make out Charles Manson and the Cielo Drive killings as basically the work of black militants and or radicals, sort of a standard Reichstag, Martinez von der Lubbe type of scenario. And we're going to take a look basically at the Manson family this evening. Now, recall that the Manson family had specific Nazi connections. We're going to review some of those this evening. It also was tied up with a satanic and slash Nazi umbrella cult called The Process, which involved elements, either active elements or spin-off elements of a number of different organizations, including elements of the Church of Scientology, apparently elements of the OTO, and we're not impugning necessarily any of these organizations, nor are we exonerating necessarily any of these organizations. The point is that these Nazi-slash-intelligence cults basically use other organizations as recruiting fodder. They spin off elements of and attempt to use elements of others. So we're neither impugning any organization or exonerating it. It's a relatively complicated situation. But again, we're taking a look at things like the Manson family killings as provocations. And again, in our Pink Triangle archive show, the Fritz Haarmann case, which we reviewed at considerable length in the the Ultimate Evil number 3, is to be borne in mind. We're going to take a look at a number of interesting intersections between the legal machinery that framed Saran Saran and the legal machinery that handled the Charles Manson case. We're going to look at the intersection between the assassination of Robert Kennedy, the Manson family provocations, which appear to have been a fascist-slash-intelligence provocation to a large extent, acting under the auspices to a certain extent of the Process umbrella cult. We're going to, in a sense, do the Nazi and intelligence connections this evening. Then we're going to go back to the Satanist cover again in our broadcast next week. But again, Satanism, a cover for Nazi and espionage activities. After taking a look at the Manson role in California neo-Nazism via tape, we're going to review intersections between the Aryan Nations, the Manson family, Robert Kennedy assassination, Lockheed, the Nixon re-election, the Nixon election campaign of 68, and a bunch of similar activities, that all on a tape section of RFA number 12. Then we're going to take a look at the connection between Roman Polanski and Sharon Tate, who were having dinner with Robert Kennedy the night before he was assassinated. We're then going to look at the intersection between a number of different people who helped set up Saran to take the fall for the Robert Kennedy assassination and those who handled the Manson situation. We're going to take a look at Los Angeles District Attorney and later California Attorney General Evel Younger, his intersection with some of the people who supposedly were defending some of the Manson family members, his intersection perhaps forming a community of interest with one of the judges involved in the case. We're going to take a look at Vincent Bugliosi, who helped prosecute the Manson family and later figured in the KCOP versus Jerry Owen case down in Los Angeles, which is in Radio Free America number 9. We're going to take a look at Evel Younger's removal of a prosecutor called Stovitz from the case, from the Manson family case. We're going to take a look at L.A. attorney Luke McKissick, his representing of Charles Manson, and his apparent declining of useful information which might have helped him get Saran Saran off on appeal. Luke McKissick handled Saran Saran's appeal. He turned away conclusive evidence there had been a second gun. We're going to take a look at Warren Commission counsel Joseph Ball and his role with Charles Manson. We're also going to take a look at Sharon Tate's father's role in military intelligence and his use of a disguise to investigate the Manson family killings. We're going to take a look at the Aryan Brotherhood neo-Nazi prison connections of Manson family member Michael Monfort and Robert Beausoleil, both of those coming from the book Helter Skelter. After that, we're going to take a look at an article from the San Francisco Examiner indicating that Michael Monfort and Nancy Pittman have apparently settled in Napa. And we're going to wind up with an article from the Napa Sentinel indicating that Napa is now the site of satanic cults involving neo-Nazis. Whether or not that is connected with the Manson family, we will speculate at some length and come back to it next week. That, in a nutshell, is what we have on tap for this evening.
And without further ado, we will go into our preamble, although we've already ambled and rambled a little bit already.
I was going to say our pre-ramble, perhaps.
But we're going to go into our preamble to the actual Radio Free America. This is sort of like a bonus, I guess. You know, it's like you get that extra little package of detergent or something when you buy the big one. This first article here is from
San Jose Mercury News.
Thank you. For May 3rd, 1988. The article is headlined, Brooks' New Love Leaves Mom Wondering.
This is from that little cutesy news, you know, where they have all the little, you know, sort of douchey poster stamp
articles. Down the sidebars.
Yeah, like some clown who makes a replica of the Statue of Liberty out of dill pickle chips or something like that. Equally, you know, Guinness World Book of Records things.
That's right. Brooks' New Love Leaves Mom Wondering. Brooke Shields has at long last found love. And with none other than Woody Harrelson, age 25, the bartender on TV's Cheers. Quote, I know we're from different backgrounds, but what do I care? Shields, age 23, was quoted as saying in Sunday's Boston Herald. You always know where you stand with Woody, unquote. That's fine for her, but what about her poor mother? Quote, I just cannot understand my daughter, said Terry Shields. I mean, the man is way beneath her standing. She could have any man in the world, but now she says she's in love, and that's that, unquote. Well, despite the fact that very few people who've ever read much about her or seen her in action could be very sympathetic with Brooke Shields' mom, Terry, who strikes one as a classic type of some sort, nonetheless, although Woody Harrelson undoubtedly himself is a very nice young man, there are certain things in Mr. Harrelson's background that might make any mother a little leery about her daughter's association with such a family.
Yeah, let's say Woody Harrelson is not the first member of the family to achieve public recognition, although his father achieved public recognition in a dramatically different fashion. Reading from The Star from February 10th, 1987, that's the tabloid publication which you'll see at the supermarket with the National Enquirer and other fare. This is by Tony Castro of The Star, again, February 10th, 1987. An article about Woody Harrelson called Cheers Barman Stands In for Murderer Dad in Bizarre Wedding Ceremony.
Ah, it's nice to have those tabloid headlines for a change.
It certainly
snaps
is.
Snaps things up.
Exactly. And when we said a red-blooded background, we meant red-blooded. Just how red and how bloody, check it out here. Cheers wacky bartender Woody Harrelson was the groom in a bizarre marriage ceremony as he stood in for his father, a twice-convicted murderer serving a life sentence in a Texas prison, and we would add perhaps thrice-convicted if all of his situations were pursued to their ultimate ends. Continuing. As news of the proxy marriage and his father's criminal past surfaced, the 24-year-old actor secluded himself with close friends on the Cheers set and at his Hollywood home. I don't condone the acts of violence my father has been accused of committing, Harrelson told friends, but he's my father, and I owe him a son's love and loyalty, unquote. Harrelson's true life background is a far cry from the Midwestern small-town upbringing of his naive Cheers character, also named Woody. Harrelson, who was born in Midland, Texas, was 11 when his father, Charles Voyed Harrelson, killed a Texas businessman in a murder-for-hire slaying and 17 when his dad murdered a San Antonio federal judge in another hitman assassination. But he remained close to his 48-year-old father, visiting him with his younger brother Brett at the maximum security prison in Huntsville, Texas. In the proxy marriage ceremony performed by Justice of the Peace James C. Adolphus in Sugarland, Texas on January 3rd, Charles Harrelson was married to Gina Adele Foster, 38, who lives in Houston. "One of my favorite programs is Cheers, but I didn't recognize him or make any connection at the time," says Judge Adolphus. "And frankly, when I did start to make a connection, it was with the father. When you start assassinating judges, you get the attention of other judges. A day or two later, I checked and found it was the same fellow who had killed a federal judge." In 1982, Woody's father was convicted of killing Judge John H. Wood on behalf of a South Texas drug kingpin who allegedly paid the older Harrelson $250,000 for the job. Wood was known for giving drug dealers stiff sentences. Woody's stepmother, Joanne Harrelson, was convicted of perjury in connection with the case and is now serving a 20-year sentence. She bought the rifle used to kill the judge. Harrelson divorced her while in prison. Well, there are a lot of things that are not mentioned in this particular article. Judge John Wood was investigating an arms for drug smuggling ring called The Company, quote-unquote, which was a major focus of ours in Radio Free America number 26. We then came back to it later on during our six-part series on the Iran-Contra scandal, Radio Free America shows 29 through 34, and we took a look at the elements of The Company and their connections with what the Christic Institute has referred to as the secret team. We took a look at James Atwood, people connecting up with Frank Turpel, the Nugenhand Bank, Merex, and a number of other interesting weapons deals and scams revolving in and around the intelligence milieu, which figures prominently in the Iran-Contra scandal. Among the revelations that Charles Harrelson made during the course of the trial, and there were a lot of interesting intelligence connections to this case, first of all, was that it was that Judge Wood was killed at the orders of the Drug Enforcement Administration because he was about to expose high-level DEA complicity in the drug traffic, which to veteran One Step Beyond listeners would perhaps elicit an editorial comment that would sound something like a long yawn. Because the complicity of high-level elements of the DEA and the drug traffic is about as mysterious as the dawn at this stage of the game, and due in part to publicity surrounding the revelations of the Iran-Contra scandal. Perhaps even more significantly than that particular revelation was another murder which Woody Harrelson was alleged to have committed, and this would, or Charles Harrelson, rather, was alleged to have committed. Let's get that straight. Woody's the kid, and the fellow who has apparently... I was going to make a nasty pun. It's been dating Brooke Shields. But Charles Harrelson, apparently Woody Harrelson would have been 2 years old when Charles Harrelson allegedly committed another killing, or perhaps three.
And talking about Charles Harrelson's supposed or asserted first big job or biggest job, here's an article from the San Francisco Examiner from November 2nd of 1982. The article is headlined, "Witness Says Hitman is Killer of Judge, JFK. Dateline San Antonio, Texas, a UPI wire story.
By the way, credit for the story to Ted Rubenstein.
"A convicted hitman claimed he killed both President John F. Kennedy and U.S. District Judge John H. Wood, Jr., and planned to use that information to bargain with the government. A lawyer who pleaded guilty to conspiracy charges in the case testified today. Joe Shagra said Charles Harrelson insisted he had killed Kennedy and even drew a map of the area in Dallas where Kennedy was shot in 1963. Shagra said Harrelson also told him that he hoped the information could get him a life sentence in a comfortable federal prison instead of the Texas penitentiary. Quote, if he made a deal with the government, he could clear up the Kennedy matter, as well as clear up the Judge Wood matter, unquote, Shagra said. Although Harrelson claimed to have been cleared by a 1980 grand jury in Wood's 1969 shooting death, he said he could still prove he killed Wood with, quote, an ace in the hole, the murder weapon itself, unquote, Shagra said. In the same visit with Shagra, September 24, 1980, Harrelson drew a second map of the area east of Dallas where he said the rifle he used to kill Wood was tossed from a bridge. Shagra reproduced the map later, and the FBI found it in a search of his home in February of 1981. Harrelson, his wife Joanne, and Elizabeth Shagra, wife of the man accused of hiring Harrelson to kill Wood, are on trial on charges relating to Wood's death. Joe Shagrage, 36, was charged with conspiracy but pleaded guilty in September and agreed to testify against Harrelson in a plea bargaining arrangement. So according to Charles Harrelson, he was part of the shooting team.
According to Joe Shagrage.
According to Joe Shagrage, he said that Charles right. Harrelson had said that he was part of the shooter's team that did for John F. Kennedy. And, of course, this is all very much too bad for Woody Harrelson, who, again, is probably a very nice young man. But, unfortunately, we are all sometimes judged by the company we keep.
Yeah, well, the interesting thing, too, is that an article, Charles Harrelson, his father, was part of an organized crime milieu involving, among others, Jack Ruby and Santos Traficante, who not only was cited by the House Select Committee on Assassinations as a probable conspirator in the assassination of John F. Kennedy, but who also was, at least until his untimely demise, a defendant in the Christic Institute suit as well. Again, the fellows like R.D. Matthews, Traficante, and others are part of the same organized crime milieu as Charles Harrelson. It's interesting, too, that in something related to the company, which had a lot of murders connected with it, Joseph Marcello, Carlos Marcello's brother, was indicted for perjury in connection with the case, and he was represented by Roy Cohn in that particular case. The fellow who heard that particular case was, and now I've gone absolutely blank, the current director of the FBI,
Judge Sessions.
Judge William H. Sessions, right, who is currently, he was the judge who heard the Harrelson case and did not pursue any of the revelations we've talked about any farther than the person of Charles Harrelson himself. He now is director of the FBI, and with the involvement of elements of the company and not only the Iran-Contra scandal, but the entire intelligence milieu and the many scams involved in or perpetrated by people in that milieu, it's interesting that William Sessions was the fellow who succeeded William Webster as director of the FBI.
All right, before we go on to the regular part of the broadcast, we have one last small article that fits into a new category we'll just make up called, what do we call it, The Sins of the Fathers and the Rising of the Sons. How's that?
You could call this Oaks and Acorns.
Oaks and Acorns.
Big oafs from little icons grow here, I guess you could say. Last week we talked about an article that we now are going to read sections of. This comes from the Washington Post of April 20th of 1988. Deals with a fellow named Herbert J. Stern, who was assisting Lawrence Walsh in his alleged investigation of the Iran-Contra scandal. He also then, as we look at his political pedigree, or his legal pedigree, I should say, political also, actually, he was the fellow who directed the grand jury investigation into the murder of Malcolm X. Interestingly enough, he may be the son of an interesting fellow as well. He may have a red-blooded background as well. We're going to talk about his father as well. Fathers and sons. When is Father's Day? It must be coming up pretty soon, Nip, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, not too much longer.
Mother's Day was last week, and I guess you could say that tonight we're talking about some fathers who are mothers, you know? At any rate, reading of the Washington Post, April 20th of 1988, this is an article by George Lardner, Jr. and Joe Picciarello, Picciarello, of the Washington Post, headlined, Stern, Counsel's Point Man on Iran-Contra Immunity. Former judge aids Walsh on pretrial hurdle. Herb Stern's father tried hard to persuade him to become a dentist, but the boy wouldn't listen. He wanted to be like his father. Bear that phrase in mind. That meant becoming a trial lawyer, grinding away at the district attorney's office in Manhattan, prosecuting penny-ante bookmakers, numbers runners, and pickpockets. But Stern doesn't remember it as tedium. Instead of becoming a dentist, he says, I sailed off to adventure, unquote. Something of an understatement under the circumstances. Now 51, but still boyish-looking, Herbert J. Stern has had plenty of adventure since graduating from the University of Chicago Law School in 1961. He was U.S. Attorney for New Jersey when he was 34 and received national attention for prosecuting corrupt New Jersey politicians and organized crime figures. Less than 3 years later, President Richard M. Nixon made him a federal judge. Note that Nixon appointed him to the federal bench. He stepped down from the bench last year to get a taste of private practice. 10 weeks ago, he took on what could be one of his toughest assignments, representing independent counsel Lawrence E. Walsh, in crucial pretrial challenges to the Iran-Contra indictment of former National Security Advisor John M. Poindexter, former White House aide Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, and two others. Skipping down on the article. Born in New York City on November 8, 1936, Stern grew up in Manhattan, where his father, Samuel Stern, was an assistant state attorney general. In 1962, young Stern became an assistant DA under the late Manhattan District Attorney Frank Hogan. He eventually was assigned to the Homicide Bureau, where he directed the grand jury investigation into the murder of Malcolm X. Well, what we're wondering here, first of all, we talked last week about oaks and acorns, and how one of the reasons one wants to study this country's political assassinations is you observe people who were bit players and perform those bit parts well, and they move on to greater and greater roles as time moves on. The assassination of Malcolm X has not received the publicity of many of the other political assassinations. Much of the rub concerns the role of Anthony Ulasewicz, head of the Bureau of Special Services, the New York City Anti-Organized Crime and Anti-Red Squad. He had infiltrated Malcolm X's organization, and in fact, one of his undercover operatives was administering mouth-to-mouth resuscitation to Malcolm X in a very famous Life magazine picture. This is totally, by the way, contraindicated in someone suffering from a chest wound, because you put air bubbles into the bloodstream, which can often cause death, even if the wound itself won't. You never give mouth-to-mouth or artificial resuscitation to somebody with a deep chest wound. It just isn't done. It's a good way of assuring that they will die, which is interesting that this was an L.A. or New York cop operating under the auspices of Anthony Ulasewicz, who later moved on to bigger and better things with the Nixon White House and the Watergate scandals. It's interesting that the people who were convicted of the assassination of Malcolm X were security people from Mosque 7, the Nation of Islam mosque in Harlem, originally founded by Malcolm X. When he broke with Elijah Muhammad, he was succeeded by a fellow by the name of Louis Farrakhan, who's achieving a lot of press these days. Farrakhan became the head of Mosque 7 and publicly called for Malcolm X's death. The thing that is so interesting about the way Malcolm X died is that his security people, most of whom were former members of the Nation of Islam and Mosque 7 themselves, apparently totally overlooked several security people from Mosque 7 who infiltrated the, the Audubon Ballroom in New York City and gunned Malcolm X down, just shot him to gristle right on the stage. The reason is that the thing that's so unusual about that is that Malcolm's security detail had been heavily alerted to the possibility of Mosque 7 security people performing an attempt on Malcolm's life. And they knew just about all of these people personally. The fact that three of them were able to infiltrate this relatively small public auditorium, apparently going right by people who not only were alerted to their malevolent presence, but who knew them personally, raises a lot of questions. If one guard had let one guy go by, but it appears that somebody with a lot of power and a lot of money and or influence was able to turn Malcolm's security detail around. The functioning of Farrakhan and the Mosque 7 Stooges, as most researchers view them, they appear to have been involved in largely as ground-level operatives. And then the cover story in the Malcolm X assassination was that basically it was a Nation of Islam inner struggle. It appears from the circumstances that it was done by the National Security Establishment. Malcolm X had been expelled from France under curious circumstances not long before, which is intriguing because, as we looked at in the Guns of November, there are strong intersections between some of the French fascists under the Secret Army Organization, the OAS, and some of the same reactionary NATO-associated elements who were involved in the John F. Kennedy assassination. So it's interesting that the French, who are historically very, very tolerant of political refugees, gave Malcolm X the bum's rush as soon as he landed at Orly Airport. He was forbidden from disembarking and ushered off French territory with uncharacteristic rudeness. It is, many researchers have inferred from this, that the French intelligence services were aware of the plans against Malcolm X's life, that apparently they were already in the pipeline, so to speak, and they didn't want to have Malcolm X buy it on French territory. At any rate, it's interesting that Herb Stern, who was allegedly helping Lawrence Walsh, overlooked just about all the information I just cited and other facts as well in the grand jury investigation into the Malcolm X assassination. Now, what's interesting is that he said he wanted to be like his father. His father is described here as Samuel Stern, an assistant state attorney general in New York State. Now, what's interesting is that a Warren Commission counsel was named Samuel A. Stern. And what we're wondering here, the $64,000 question, the food for thought and grounds for further research on the part of our diligent and capable One Step Beyond audience is Samuel A. Stern, the father of Herbert Stern, and has indeed Herbert Stern followed in his father's red-blooded footsteps?
And we're turning that one over to you folks, and we know that a lot of you out there are already, the little lights are lighting up and the bells are buzzing and everything's going, and you'll find out and give us that answer back. So we'll just kind of make it an open contest. We're going to take a break. Entropic process by which our government is falling apart will be probably more willing to agree than they would have before that indeed we are seeing a repeat of the Reagan experiment in California on a grander scale. Well, one of the key issues, one of the key things that we had always cited as one of the elements of the important elements of the Reagan administration experiment in California was the use of selective terror. The appearance of strange political slash religious slash, and slash here is an operant word by all means, groups that kind of popped up all over the place and set the state into a frenzy and helped to polarize reactions and mobilize the middle class behind such benevolent organizations as the Los Angeles Police Department, anti-terrorist bureaus and things like that. And only after the fact was it discovered and mostly ignored that most of these groups, the Symbionese Liberation Army, the Manson family, etc., themselves had some rather odd ties to the security establishment.
Right. Building in large measure on Mae Brussel's landmark work, investigating organizations like the Symbionese Liberation Army, in which it was revealed that large numbers of the California violences, as Mae has referred to them, were in fact not random groups of drug-crazed hippies, you know, with knives and bad intentions, but in fact were people who, if not themselves full-time federal agents, who were acting at the behest of the law enforcement community and elements of the military and intelligence community. We did in Radio Free America number 23 a long examination of terror in California under Ronald Reagan, and that is on permanent file with archives on audio for people who would like to look into it. We've looked at considerable length over the course of these broadcasts at the influence of the Third Reich on our national security establishment, and in the second part of The Ultimate Evil, also in our archive show about the Pink Triangle, we talked about the Fritz Haarmann incident, an apparent very sophisticated political provocation in which a deranged homosexual who also was a police informant and apparently ran a network of police informants for the Hanover Police Department in Weimar, Germany, was involved in a series of sensational killings in which he chopped up small children and marketed their flesh as horse meat. And this had the effect of defaming liberalism in Weimar, Germany. The leadership of the Weimar Republic was tarred as being a bunch of people who were sympathetic to perversion and who had created a lawless, mindless, perverted environment in which people like Fritz Haarmann could flourish. Now, the obvious connections of Fritz Haarmann to the Hanover Police Department, which was headed up by Gustav Noske, the people who founded the Freikorps, didn't receive as much notice. In much the same way, the provocations, apparent provocations, the California violences in California, although not to most eyes ostensibly political events, in fact, exist in a highly political context. As we're going to look at this evening, not only were many of the same was a large percentage of the same cast of characters we see in the Robert Kennedy assassination also involved with the Manson family. Not only was the Manson family an explicit Nazi organization, but those kinds of killings, the Santa Cruz mass murders, the kidnapping of Patty Hearst, the depredations of the Symbionese Liberation Army, the Manson family, those kinds of things gave the impression not only to people in California, but people all over the United States, that in California people were seeing the ultimate manifestation of the muddle-headed, liberal, permissive policies of the 60s, in which all sorts of criminals who should have been salted away or executed, salted away for the rest of their lives, are executed, undisciplined, anti-patriotic, irresponsible, ungrateful children who weren't happy to be in America would take drugs and running around slicing up law-abiding citizens like the LaBiancas and the Tates into shish kebab, and that generally we needed not only more prisons and better prisons, well, not necessarily better prisons, but more and larger prisons. We needed more and harder police, better armed, better trained, and equipped with powers that they didn't previously have to deal with this menace. And in general, the progressive political leadership of this country and this state in particular was seen as a bunch of addle-brained liberals who simply were turning the country over to the dogs and the state over to the dogs for want of a little bit of bite.